thought today, as we are having our youth day, that we would discuss a little bit about, primarily in the book of Proverbs, about six keys to success and long life and a happy existence. Things that Solomon told us very clearly that ought to be priorities in our lives, starting at an early age. I was reading the account of Josiah last night, and I marveled at the fact that he was only 8 years old when he first came to the throne. And he was only 16 in the eighth year of his reign when he began to destroy all of the temples, the false idols, and all of the other problems in the land of Israel as well as in Judah. Can you imagine a 16-year-old boy making decrees to tear down all of the churches in this country, or all of the false images and all of the obelisks and all of the other pagan worship, or sending out an edict to all the people in the United States saying we're no longer going to be observing Christmas? Can you imagine a 16-year-old boy doing that? Well, he was only 26 when he actually started to rid the whole country of everything, and began to then preparing for an observation of the Passover that was the greatest Passover that has ever been kept from the days of Samuel up until that time. That was a 26-year-old boy, or a 26-year-old man, okay. He had grown up to a man by that time. But the point is that God can use young people. God can use all ages of people. But what he does like us to do is start early in training and understanding. And so I have six major keys of thinking about life and about what is life. And I'd like to just briefly go through some of them. The number one is probably the most difficult in this day and age. And that number one point is that we ought to know there is a God. Know there is a God. I cannot believe or imagine how much garbage is being fed into people's minds and thoughts about evolution and about substitute gods and about how everything came into existence without God. And so they can look at the creation, they can look out and they can see all of the marvelous things that God has created. Like Scott was ringing out yesterday in one of the sermonettes about the beauty that we can behold and the intricacies and the natural beauty that God has created. And yet we can try to claim that, well, it all just came into being. It just happened to come about, right? That the birds of the air come from reptiles, which is one of their major beliefs. You know what? I don't really see a whole lot of similarity between reptiles and birds. But somehow they know that they know that there is a connection between the two. So it is very important in our lives as young people that you prove to yourself and do some study and thinking about to overcome the concept of evolution and the excusing of man. Because it is only God in our minds and in our thoughts that will, let's say, check our own actions. They will check or be a check on our beliefs. Is by our belief that there is a God. If we do not believe there is a God, there is no ultimate source of determination of what's right and wrong. We just choose for ourselves what's right and wrong. God is the only way in which our thinking and things can be altered and changed. go back to the book of Romans for a moment and see what Paul says in the book of Romans chapter 1. Now, this is not just for young people. It is for adults, all the age groups that need to understand this. But as I've told a story before, I remember the shock I had one time after 4 years of college, and one of my college roommates, he left the college in his senior year, and he left, and he later got back in touch with some of us, and he said, "I don't even believe there is a God anymore." After almost 4 years of Ambassador College, that he had come to the conclusion that he didn't and could not prove that there is a God. You know, Paul says in Romans chapter 1, and picking up the story in verse 20, he says, "For the invisible things of him," that is God, "from the creation of the world are clearly seen." They're not invisible, and they are not dimly seen, but they are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, and his divinity, his Godhead, his power, his rulership, his love, his consideration, his care. All of those things are manifested by the things that are around us in the creation itself and how he does things. So then he goes on that they are saying that, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, and they were not thankful, but they became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Now we'll read another verse in a few minutes, but what makes a person foolish? Denial of the fact that there is a God. That's the biggest step toward becoming a foolish individual. But professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man. You ought to go back to the book of Isaiah sometime. I'm not going to do that now. And read some of the comments that are made by God about himself. And kind of in a mocking way, he talks about that they take a piece of wood and they make an idol out of one part of the wood. And then when what's left, they burn in a fire. And that's supposed to be God, right? That they will worship it. A piece of wood that can be burned. And he makes some pretty astounding statements back there about what man's foolishness really is. So they changed the glory of God, the incorruptible God, into an image. Whatever image they might make that they worship, whether it be birds, four-footed beasts, or creeping things, whatever. And because they did that, he says, verse 24, "So God gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts." Denying God leads to a life of immorality, a life of carelessness, and of disaster. And it leads to a darkened mind, it said. He gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies. And he changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator. I think we would be amazed at how Satan has effectively used evolution to destroy the people, all peoples, some way or the other, that they can try to show that they don't have to obey some ultimate authority in their life, but that they can choose what's right and what's wrong. And it's a subtle, insidious way in which they get into our lives. Going back to the book of Psalm 14, where David says in Psalm 14, pretty point blank statement in Psalm the 14th chapter, and verse 1, he says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And they are corrupt, and they have done abominable works. There is none, and that does good. And he mentions, he says, that the fool says in his heart. He may not even say it verbally, outwardly, but what David is saying is, even if the thoughts in the mind, in the heart, are that I am free to do whatever I want, go wherever I want, act the way I want, that will lead to all being foolish individuals. We have to come to understand, and it's a long process, but as you are never too young to come to a faith to believe there is a God. To believe. And that is not foolishness. And it's not something to be ridiculed when somebody knows that they believe there is a God, even though sometimes maybe your friends and other people might ridicule you, right? Make fun of you to make you think that smart people don't believe in God, right? Intelligent people don't believe in God. It's a figment of imagination, whereas God turns it right around and he says, people who don't believe in God are the ones who are foolish and are ignorant and don't know what they're doing. So we have to believe there is a God. For the rest of your life, that is going to be the keel on your boat of life. That will keep that boat steady in going the right direction, not allowing it to tip over when a few waves or other troubles come up. It's your rudder, it's your steering device, it's what will keep you balanced in your life, to know that there is somebody there who you're going to have to give an account to one day for all of our actions, right? Everything we think and do. If you don't believe that you're ever going to have to give an account for your actions, you don't really have anything to keep you from doing whatever you want, do you? Act the way you want, believe what you want, or whatever else. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 13, whereas Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes, after probably one of the more negative books in all of the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes. But in chapter 12 and verse 9, he says, and moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he gave a good heed and sought out, and he set in order many proverbs. And then he comes down to verse 13 and he says, so let us hear the conclusion of this whole matter. The whole thing about life, where we're going, what we're doing, how we're acting. Let's consider the conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. Not just the duty of man, it is what makes for a whole man. If you do not have that element in your life of knowing there is a God, you are not a whole being, a whole person, a whole man. I want to read a couple of quotes from evolutionists themselves. Admissions. Staggering what they will admit when they really are pinned down and made to admit what they want. He says, the famous evolutionist, quite plainly states some of the great doubts involved in the theory of evolution. And he asks, how can the processes of evolution cause such intricate, marvelous mechanisms as we see all about us? You might take the wing of a bird, or the wing of a butterfly, or a lot of other things out there in nature. Pretty intricate, pretty well designed. They are marvelous mechanisms as we see all about us and with which we see and think. And then he says his answer, notice it carefully what his answer is. How can chance produce elaborate design? In a word, are you not asking us to believe too much? The answer is no. All this is not too much to believe once one has grasped the way the process works.
Oh, yeah,
sure. What process? Then he comes on down and says, notice this further admission of the utter incredibility of any actual evolutionary process taking place. Like a bird's wing coming from an alligator or something like that. He says, the evolutionists themselves admit the mathematical impossibility of this happening by chance. For instance, the chances that such evolutionary steps really could have occurred are said to be one chance in a thousand to the millionth power. Now, you know what power is, right? If you got 2 squared, that little 2 up there is the power. If you got 1,000, and then you put that little number up there, 1,000,000, it's incredible what that turns out to be. In fact, he goes on and he says, this scientist or this people say, one chance and a thousand to a millionth power. And what that means is staggering. Said the evolutionist, quote, a thousand to the millionth power, when written out, becomes the figure 1 with 3,000,000 zeros. Now, how do you like those odds? 1 with 3,000,000 zeros after it. And you know what that would take to write? That would take 3 volumes of 500 pages each to put the zeros in. Now, you can look at your encyclopedia, and you've got a 500-page encyclopedia, and you take volume 1, 2, and 3, and fill them all with zeros. And that's what the chances are of the evolutionary process being fact. Now, how would you like to bet on that horse? I mean, it's bad enough to bet on a lottery ticket that's 1 in 2 or 3 million people or something like that. But we're talking about 1 with 3 volumes of zeros after. And they say we have blind faith to believing God. Kind of stupid, isn't it? I think we have a little bit more evidence when you look at what God has created and you see the beauty of it. So he goes on and he says, actually, this is a meaningless large figure, but it shows what a degree of improbability natural selection has to surmount and to circumvent. 1 with 3,000,000 zeros after it is the measure of the unlikeliness of a horse becoming a horse. That's pretty fantastic. Just an awesome figure. Then he comes on down and he finishes and he says, it has happened. Oh, no. But what caused such a phenomenal occurrence as a horse? And this is the same author, he just told us, it's 1 with 3,000,000 zeros after it, or with 1,000,000 zeros after it. And now he says, but what caused such a phenomenal occurrence as a horse? Did God Almighty created it? Not so, claimed the evolutionist. Quote, it has happened thanks to the workings of natural selection and the properties of living substance which make natural selection inevitable. How do you like your chances? What's your odds? And yet, they will talk about their evolution and how it is their God and what they want. Now there are some other fantastically large figures that you could go into as far as evolution is concerned. But after all of that, they still say, and then we'll come back, but we know it is a fact. One in three, you know, a million zeros behind it, but we know that's fact. Come on. So, number one point, you must come to an understanding that evolution is not and cannot stand upon its own merits. It will not stand on its own cognizance at all. God will. And the more you deeply you search into and search out the facts about creation, the more you will recognize there is a God. So, first off, believe there is a God. Prove there is a God. If some of us as adults haven't proved and know that you know that there is a God, then I would suggest perhaps you ought to consider those three volumes of zeros and whether you want to believe in it. Number two, seek wisdom. Seek wisdom. Now there are three things. There's knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. A lot of people have a hard time separating those things. They don't know what the difference is, but real quickly, let me say, knowledge is just information. It's data. It's numbers, figures, all of those things. Understanding is to understand the how of that knowledge. How does it work? What does it mean? How does it apply? To understand it. You know, sometimes we can have knowledge about what God's word says, but do we really understand how it works and what it does? And wisdom is to know the difference. Okay. Wisdom is to know the difference between knowledge and understanding. How does it work? And sometimes we people use knowledge as if they think they have an understanding about it, and when they don't. Wisdom is to know the limitations of how much you understand about the facts and the figures and the information of how it works. Back in the book of Proverbs again, Solomon gives us some clues about this in the book of Proverbs chapter 2. And beginning with verse 1, we'll read the first 7 verses. It says, my son, if you will receive my words and hide my commandments with you, so that you incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry after knowledge and lift up your voice for understanding, and if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hid treasures, then you shall understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom, out of his mouth comes knowledge and understanding, and he lays up sound wisdom for the righteous. So seeking wisdom as if it were a hidden treasure. We have, as all of you probably know, we have some mining claims and mining properties, and frankly, I have never found gold lying on top of the ground. It takes a lot of digging. It takes a lot of work. It takes blasting. It takes excavation. It takes finding the vein and then following the vein. And that's not easy to do in itself. It's to follow a vein through a mountainous territory. But that's somewhat the way it is with wisdom. You find that vein and you follow that vein of precious material and precious gold or silver or whatever it might be. It takes excavation. It takes work. It takes diligence. doesn't just happen to come because your name is so-and-so, right? Wisdom does not come by name. It comes by diligence, by work. Over in the book of Psalms, chapter 110 of the book of Psalms, the tie between these two things of God and wisdom, he says in the book of Psalms, 110th Psalm, or the 111th Psalm actually, in verse 10, where he says, actually, let's read this whole psalm. It says in verse 1, praise you, the Lord, and I will praise the Lord with my whole heart in the assembly of the upright and in the congregation. The works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. For the work is honorable and glorious, and his righteousness endures forever. He has made this his wonderful works to be remembered. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion. But then on dropping on down to verse 8, they stand fast forever and ever and are done in truth and uprightness. He sent redemption unto his people. He has commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name, and the fear of the Lord is the very beginning of wisdom. And a good understanding have they that do his commandments. Obedience will lead to good understanding of what is right and wrong. So that fear of God, understanding of God, is the beginning of wisdom. You find a lot about wisdom in the first few chapters of the book of Proverbs. I'm not going to go through all of that. I just don't have time to go through all of it. But I suggest as members of God's church that we ought to spend a considerable amount of time in the book of Proverbs. In the book of Proverbs. And recognize that God inspired Solomon to be able to put down, even though he may have not lived by a lot of it, he put down many of the qualities about wisdom and what he needed. In fact, if we're like Solomon, we ought to be like he was in the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 1. When he was becoming and about to become the king over the nation of Israel, he said in chapter 1 of the book of 2 Chronicles, that he wanted to have wisdom and sought God for wisdom and to ask for what he wanted. And verse 9, he says, now, O Lord God, let your promise unto David my father be established, for you have made me king over a people like the dust of the earth in multitude. Give me now wisdom and knowledge that I may go out and come in before this people. For who can judge this, your people, this that is so great? And God said to Solomon, because this was in your heart, and you did not ask for riches, wealth, and honor, nor the long life, but have asked wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may judge my people over whom I have made you king, wisdom and knowledge is granted to you. We can do the same thing as individuals. Go to God and ask him for the wisdom to know. In James chapter 1 and verse 5, we are told that if you lack wisdom, go to him who gives bountifully and he will give it to us. Over in James, back in the New Testament, in James chapter 1, he says in James 1 and verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given him. And what are the fruits of that kind of wisdom? Just turn over a page or so over in chapter 3 and beginning in verse 17. Let's back up to verse 13. He says, who is wise man and endowed with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conduct his works with meekness of wisdom. And then coming down to verse 17, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure and peaceable, gentle and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. So we need to believe there is a God and then seek the wisdom that is from God that we might know. And it's all available here in this book. God made it available for us all. The third one, now I'm probably treading on dangerous ground, but the third one is to honor your father and mother. One of the basic tenets of a successful life is to honor your father and your mother. That's where we began to develop the habit of knowing that we're held accountable for our actions by the way we treat our father and our mother. That we are recognizing that parents are due respect and honor. Doesn't mean that we always believe everything or totally agree with everything. But let me say this, there is never a time to dishonor a father or a mother. Now, you may have to do some more research as what do we mean by dishonoring, but we ought to, just from the fact that they are your father and your mother, that we honor them. And it does not mean that you always will always do everything they say.
Okay.
But do you honor them? Do you respect them? Do you have a belief that God holds you responsible for that? You know, this fifth commandment is a tie between the first four, which is loving God, and the last six, which is loving man. And right in the middle of there is happens to be the fifth one that talks about honoring father and mother. It goes both directions. It goes toward honoring God, and it goes toward honoring other human beings that are there. And so we must honor father and mother. It was so important, in fact, that God put it as one of the big ten, didn't he? I mean, there's a lot of things that could have been put down as one of the Ten Commandments that he chose to put this one. Now, I was a young person at the time, and I honestly didn't always honor my parents the way I should have. Now I regret, because I can't even say sorry anymore. But I certainly never was the way I hear some people talk to their parents, and I think, man, I would have been flat-headed if I had talked to my dad and mom that way. They would have, I don't know what would have happened, but I cannot believe sometimes, even on television and some of the family programs and comedies that they call comedy with modern life, the things they say about their parents are incredible of what they do. And they find it funny. Does that mean that you cannot discuss things with parents? No. And it may not even mean that you might not disagree with your parents on some things. But even in that disagreement, there should not be a dishonoring or a disrespect for who they are. Man, I read that verse back there in Exodus chapter 21. And in Exodus 21 and verse 17, the one of the laws of God is that if you curse your father or mother, you will be put to death, right? Oh, yeah. I could have been put to death a lot of times. And I didn't really use bad language. I just showed the actions and didn't do what I, you know. My tendency was just go walk off as if you didn't hear. Okay. That's total disrespect to do that. And I was a little disrespectful in those ways. But it didn't get me into the position or where I should have been. I could have learned a lot quicker if I'd had that kind of love for mother and brother and my family. It's interesting that in Ephesians chapter 6, just going back a little bit here where we were in James, back to the book of Ephesians chapter 6, in verse 1, where he says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise." There is a promise that is connected to that law about honoring our father and your mother. And that promise is long life, right? Long life. Proverbs 1 and verse 8 talks about the law of your mother. Mothers should have a lot to say in child rearing and in bringing up their children. In fact, if you read through the kings and the chronicles about the kings and of Israel and Judah, there's one thing that you will tend to find out, and that is if you have a bad king, nothing is said about the mother. But if you have a good king, you know almost in every case the name of the mother is given. I wonder why that is. The name of the mother is mentioned. Because that mother probably had a lot to do with the way that child was brought up and the way it was taught. Mothers, I think, sometimes don't recognize or realize the power that is in their realm, that God puts in their realm of teaching and training. It's not just the correction. It is the instruction. It is the law. It is the method by which you have, in a more soft way, of being able to stimulate the thoughts and the actions and the beliefs of a teenager. And you will find, especially that is true, that mothers tend to relate to their sons more than what fathers sometimes will. Whereas fathers tend to relate to daughters more than the girls. I don't know why that is. Maybe opposites attract. I don't know. But, and that does not mean the mothers can have great relationships with their daughters. And it doesn't mean the husband cannot have great relationships with their son. I'm just saying that over the years, you kind of observe that a lot of times the mothers have a better relationship with their sons than they do the daughter. I've seen in a lot of cases where daughters can be extremely disrespectful to their mothers, right? You ever notice that? Very disrespectful. All right, number 4, we get on to, is to recognize that life is only temporary. Life is temporary. David said in Psalm 90 in verse 12 that he wanted God to teach him to count his days, or to recognize that life doesn't go on forever, and you better start learning that as early as possible, that the time is going to run out one day. James chapter 4 tells us that life is but a vapor. It's here today and it's gone tomorrow, right? Finished. And you will be amazed when you get old and gray and looking back at how quickly that life is gone. It just seems like yesterday that I was running around on the farm up in Oregon. And that's been 70 years ago. And time has gone on. So we need to recognize. I want to turn over to Ecclesiastes 12, again, where we were earlier. Solomon has an interesting way of putting this in Psalm, or in Ecclesiastes, and chapter 12, where he says, verse 1, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. While the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when you shall say, I have no pleasure in them. I'm talking to Jim Bernhauser. We had mentioned him on the Sabbath over at the first last Holy Day. Here he is, 80-some years old. He's always been very self-sufficient, capable, taking care of all of these needs, never having to depend on anybody else or anything else, and now all of a sudden he finds himself not able to do that. And where he now has to lean on somebody else to do things for him, and if there's one thing that's the hardest thing for him to do, is to allow somebody else to have to do something for him. He hates doing it. Because he still wants to mow his own lawns, even though he can't. He wants to do all the things that he's always done. And the hardest thing for his wife, Betsy, to do is to see her husband now having to depend on somebody else. But guess what? We're all going to get there someday, somewhere. Because life is temporary. And so he says in verse 2, it says, while the sun or the light or the moon or the stars be not darkened, and nor the clouds return after the rain. In other words, when your eyesight is not too poor, until you can still see. And verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, and the grinders cease because they are few. Talking about your teeth all having fallen out or been pulled out. They don't do the job they used to do. And the doors that shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low, and he shall rise up in the voice of, or rise up at the voice of the bird. You don't sleep very solidly or soundly anymore. You hear every last little noise that comes along. Some of us are getting there already, right? So he goes through the rest of that chapter, and he's just talking about the frailty of human life that does come. In verse 6 he says, or ever the silver cord be loosened, talking about the spinal cord, or the golden bowl be broken, talking about that head and the spinal cord working, or the pitcher be broken of the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. And then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. So we are to remember God, recognize that we are temporary. I know that's hard. I look back and I think back to my high school career and my college career, and people could have told me you were going to get old one day, and I wouldn't have believed it. because I'm just not the way a young person's mind works. But what we need to do is, like David said, pray that God will help us have the wisdom to be able to see our temporariness. And very quickly, then the last two, and I won't take a lot of time on these two, is to make a lifelong profession of education and learning. Make it a lifelong process. You do not cease to receive education when you graduate from high school. It is a lifelong process to increase knowledge, increase understanding, increase wisdom. Do a lot of reading. Do a lot of study. And that does not mean that I think everybody should have to go to college. I don't necessarily agree with it. But I do say everybody should have a lifelong desire to keep learning as long as God gives them a mind to be able to learn and to grasp knowledge. That we don't just kind of waste away the rest of our lives. Don't be short in our long-range vision of seeing. Proverbs 27, verse 17 says, iron sharpens iron. Use parents, use other people, your knowledge, contributing to what others do, and sharing input, possibilities. But you have to be willing to gain information and insight from other people. There's only one problem with iron sharpening iron, and that is you better use it right or you're going to dull. Okay. There is a right way for iron to sharpen iron, but there's a wrong way. And sometimes that depends on who you are spending your time with. Let the iron sharpen the iron in a correct way. I mean, a file can do a great job in sharpening a hoe. But you don't take a file and just go straight across the top of it. That's not going to do it. It's going to be as dull as an old hoe. Okay. And finally, number six is develop a good work ethic. A good work ethic. I mean, Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10, do with all your might what your hand finds to do. Be willing to labor. Be industrious. Be willing to go out and do those things. Don't wait for the perfect time. Interesting proverb in Ecclesiastes in chapter 11, Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 18. Not 11, 18. Anyway. Oh, here it is, verse 4. And 3 and 4 of chapter 11. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if the rain falls toward the south or toward the north, the place where the tree falls, there it shall be. Verse 4, he that obeys the wind shall not sow. And he that regards the clouds shall not reap. Now, what does he mean by that? What he's saying is, if you're waiting to find a perfect day to go out and plow, you're not going to find it. Sometimes there still may be a little bit of rain coming. Or if you're waiting for the perfect time and the clouds have all gone before you go out to reap your harvest, you're not going to do it. God, that perfect time will never come. So you have to be industrious, and sometimes at the most inclement weather, but you don't let that stop you from being able to go on out. Proverbs 22, back a couple of pages, in chapter 22 of Proverbs, it says in verse 13, the slothful man says, there's a lion without. I shall be slain in the streets. You know? I'm not going to go out and go to work. There's a lion out there. Well, that lion may be, well, I don't know. I just don't feel like driving today. Or it could be a lot of different things. But so the point is that we need to develop a good work ethic, which unfortunately, a lot of people in today's society do not have. They like getting paid for what they don't do. Work hard. Be willing to work hard. Now, I can say that looking back at some long, long hours of work, but it did pay off in the dividend of at least having a certain amount of work ethic. Growing up on the farm there in Oregon, I mean, we started at 3:30 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't get home until sometimes 10 o'clock at night. I remember of having to milk 3 and 4 cows every morning before I caught the bus at 7 o'clock to go to school. There was a lot of chores to do, and it doesn't mean I always liked it. It doesn't mean I didn't try to palm it off onto somebody else sometimes. But it still teaches. So have a good work ethic. So those are just six of the foundational principles that guarantee a successful, profitable life, based upon God's word, upon what God revealed through Solomon and others. They are for our recognition and to learn early in our lives the value of knowing these six key elements, key foundational principles of what life is all about.